This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, a new award-winning film tackles the epidemic of rape that took place in the Jim Crow South.
Reese Taylor, a 24-year-old mother, was gang raped by six white young men, but she didn't keep quiet. And now Nancy Bersky has made a film telling her story.
We talk more about how the United States is failing to come to the aid of Puerto Rico.
Trump didn't even acknowledge the disaster for 5 days, went out to New Jersey and played golf instead. Then he finally got down there and was throwing paper towels at his audience.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The number of women raped in the Jim Crow South were staggering. Because of the danger to their lives and the futility of getting justice, most women did not report the crimes, and their stories, therefore, went unknown. Reese Taylor's story was not part of this hidden history. As a 24-year-old, she was gang-raped by six white men in 1944 in a small, rural Alabama town. Mrs. Taylor spoke up and bravely identified her rapists. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, sent Rosa Parks, later of the 1955 Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott fame, down to investigate and build a movement to shine a public spotlight on the crime. She rallied support and triggered an unprecedented outcry for justice. It ultimately was a failed effort. Despite widespread publicity in the black press, including newspapers in New York City, Detroit, and Philadelphia, plus a massive letter-writing campaign which put pressure on the Alabama governor, two grand juries failed to indict the rapists, and an Alabama assistant attorney general issued a report exonerating the criminals. This is the focal point of a new film titled The Rape of Reese Taylor, written, directed, and produced by Nancy Bersky. It recently had its North American premiere at the New York Film Festival. The film was awarded the Human Rights Night's Special Prize for Human Rights this year at the 74th Venice Biennale. Nancy has directed, written, and produced a number of award-winning films and is a member of the American Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Nancy Bersky, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's good to be here.
In the early 1940s in rural Alabama, black women were even afraid to walk alone down the street. What was it like for them in the Jim Crow South?
Black women were afraid to walk down the street. They were often accosted and assaulted and all too often raped by white boys and white men. There was a climate there that lent itself to this kind of behavior, which was, you know, it was hidden. I'm not saying it was out in the open all the time, but on some level it was acceptable. And, I mean, white boys saw it as a rite of passage. They inherited this mentality from slavery when plantation owners felt they owned the bodies of black women and very often would rape or sleep with black women, whether the women wanted it or not, in order to increase the number of young children on the plantation, young black children. It actually helped their economy. So that was a mentality that was inherited through Jim Crow. There was no legal recourse. That's what's so amazing about this story.
Nancy, tell us what happened to Reese Taylor. Who was she?
Okay, Reese Taylor was a 24-year-old African-American wife and mother, a very religious woman, a sharecropper, who was walking home from church one night, September 3rd in 1944, and she gets stopped on the road by a car of seven white boys. I say boys because they were young. They were age 14 to 18. And they basically pull her into the car. She had been with two other people, but they pull her away from the other people, and they kidnap her, and they drive her to a deserted pecan grove, and they spend the next 4 or 5 hours raping her.
Did she report this crime?
that's what's so incredible about Recy Taylor. Recy Taylor does report this crime. She speaks up. Most women, and this did happen all too frequently, most women were afraid for their lives. They didn't report it. They were not only afraid for their own lives, but they were afraid for their families' lives. And so they would be quiet. And most men that were there to support them and their families knew that there wasn't much that anyone would do anyway. So the families typically did not speak up. But Recy Taylor was different. Recy Taylor had the strength of her faith and the strength of a very supportive family. And she knew what had happened to her was wrong. So she did speak up. She reported it that night.
And what did the local authorities, I believe it was a sheriff, do?
They arrested one person, and I'm not even sure it was a formal arrest. They just brought him to where Recy Taylor was. She was at the sheriff's office, and she pointed that boy out as one of the perpetrators, and they said, okay. They didn't bring in anybody else, and they let him go on some kind of bond. So, you know, it was pretty clear that there was not a lot of energy behind the case initially. They then have a hearing a month later. And these are boys that she identifies. Everybody knows who they are. They don't get indicted.
So they rounded up the other
teenagers.
Yeah, and what's amazing is that this is a small town. Everybody knows each other.
They lived within yards of each other. She could have shouted to one of them across the way. She worked for the sheriff as a laundress, and they all knew each other. The rest of the family delivered groceries to these families. One of them owned a taxi cab company, they all knew each other.
So there was no doubt that what she said was true. I mean, they all knew that. They just covered it up. Am I right?
It was a major cover-up.
Was the sheriff related to any of these young men?
Yes, he was. Sheriff Louis Corbett was, I think, the great uncle of one of the young men. He was a very popular sheriff, and we have in our film one of the family members of one of these rapists talking about how if you went into jail, if you were put in jail, you had to go because he usually let people off. You had to, you know, the bar was pretty high for you to be arrested in Abbeville. Everybody knew everybody, and they were very friendly with each other.
Well, let's talk about Rosa Parks and her role. She was an investigator for the NAACP. At that time, was a very radical organization, a very courageous organization. And she had been an investigator for a while, and she came down to see what she could do. Talk about her role, please.
Okay, well, when you say investigator, what you're really saying is she was a rape investigator because she was going after, she was looking into these cases of women who were either too afraid to speak up and she tried to find out more about what had happened to them or did speak up and weren't getting any justice. But again, very few did speak up. If they spoke up, it was very quiet and it was under the radar. So she tried to gather as much information as she could. She traveled from Montgomery to Abbeville, which wasn't far. And Abbeville, she felt a personal connection there because some of her family members had come from Abbeville and she'd actually lived there for a short period of time. But she was extremely interested in this case. She went to visit Recy Taylor in her home. The sheriff is driving by. He's driving by and he just doesn't want to leave her alone. And he basically throws her out of the house. He tells her she has to leave. She leaves and she comes back. And this time he physically throws her out of the house. She is thrown down a flight of stairs and she leaves. But she manages to convince Recy and her husband, Willie Guy, and their child to move up to Montgomery, where she puts her in a boarding house. And they form a committee. This is after the first indictment, when they all realize they have to put pressure on the governor then to do another indictment, to have another grand jury hearing. And so they go up to Montgomery and they start creating noise. They start a movement. They create a committee called the Committee for Equal Justice for Mrs. Recy Taylor. And they develop a lot, you know, a tremendous amount of energy behind seeking justice for Recy Taylor.
Yeah, they wanted to get a grand jury to indict these criminals so that they would be brought to trial. And the first grand jury wouldn't do it.
That's
but
right.
They were able to get a second grand jury.
That's correct.
What happened
and
then?
Well, and they even did they had a more thorough investigation where one of the governor's assistants interviews all the boys. And they all talk about the rape. And they actually admit in their deposition that they had raped. Many of them say that. One says he didn't do it. But the others talk about the fact that they did sleep with Recy Taylor in the forest, in this pecan grove. But they say she's a prostitute.
Yeah, and they gave her money, they say.
They say they gave her money. So that's their defense. And that was the common defense at those times and actually still is today.
Yeah, here's a young woman, happily married with a little child, and they said she was a prostitute. And they physically injured her, didn't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, for 4 hours, one night, six men, there had to be physical injuries.
Was she able to have children
after that?
She
never had any other children. But let me just speak to one thing you just mentioned. You know, I think we understand today, though people didn't understand then, that even if you're a sex worker, it's still a crime. You know, you can't rape anybody. You can, if someone says no, that means no. And so though people in those days used the idea that she was a prostitute as their defense, and they continue to do that today. This happened recently in Oklahoma with a cop who raped 13 women who he accused of being prostitutes. He's now serving 3 life sentences. So things have changed.
How did the public manifest its support? You mentioned that there was sort of an uprising of interest.
Well, what they did do is they managed to get black newspapers and eventually white newspapers to write about the case. What would happen is because women would not accuse their attackers or not speak up, there was no record. And if the newspapers aren't writing about it, then juries and judges have plausible deniability when it comes to admitting that this all happened. So by getting the black newspapers to write about it, which they did much more frequently than white newspapers, and then eventually the white newspapers, because they felt the pressure reading the stories in the black newspapers, then suddenly it becomes real. They had a huge rally in Harlem at the Hotel Teresa. And hundreds of people showed up, and lots of people signed petitions. So eventually there was enough pressure put on Governor Chauncey Sparks to have this other grand jury.
And what happened with that grand jury?
They don't get indicted again. Hmm. Recy Taylor never gets justice. That's what's amazing. Even with those depositions, there is not an indictment. And, you know, it's not a question of witnesses. It's not a question of the facts. It's a question of the color.
What about the report from the Alabama Assistant Attorney General who the governor appointed to investigate?
That's what I'm talking about. Those are the questions that were asked of those boys. That's the Assistant Attorney General that questioned all of them. And we have that deposition in our film. Mm-hmm. And you hear those boys in a cold, clinical way talk about what they did in that night in the forest. It's really chilling. They contradict each other in many ways, so you know that they're lying. But they're also, they repeat certain things in such a robotic way that it's truly chilling to hear them talk about this.
Nancy, you interviewed Recy Taylor's brother and sister, and I was struck when I watched, and I watched the film twice, I was struck by the poise and the dignity of these people. What was it like to interview them?
Exactly that. They were incredibly poised. They were incredibly dignified. Robert Corbett, who was 9 years old when this rape took place, has devoted his entire life to exposing the injustice around his sister's story. His sister was like a mother to him because his mother had died when he was very young, and so she brought him up. But I think even if that weren't the case, he felt that there was so much injustice, and he felt their family had been so wronged that he really spent years of his life trying to uncover more information about what happened. And that wasn't easy because the system in Abbeville, and I can't say exactly who did this, but I can tell you that there's a systemic cover-up of this case, that there were you went to the newspapers and you tried to find clips about it. There was nothing. You go to a library and you look in the yearbook for a picture of one of the rapists. It's cut out of the yearbook. You know, it's really amazing. We spent a lot of time researching it. And as you know, there was a book written about this earlier, which is what inspired our film, called At the Dark End of the Street by Daniel McGuire. And Robert Corbett worked with Danielle to help her shore up the information in her book. And so he was extremely committed to not only exposing this case, but talking to us when it was time to make this movie.
And then he came up to New York for the premiere.
I understand he was here in New York. Yeah, he was wonderful. He came to New York. We had the world premiere at the Venice Film Festival in September, and he came to Venice. He had his 81st birthday on the night of our premiere at the New York Film Festival. So we celebrated with him. And his entire family was there. His family is just the most beautiful family and also have the same kind of dignity.
70 years later, the state of Alabama actually apologized to Mrs. Taylor. H. Rapp Brown, head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the days of the Civil Rights Movement, once remarked that, quote, in the halls of justice, the only justice is in the halls. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, an apology 70 years later really isn't enough. I think that this case will go down in history as, you know, a serious and a profound injustice, not only to Recy Taylor, but to so many other women who were assaulted and molested. The fact that this legacy is not even known is such an injustice. I'm glad they apologized to her. She was glad they apologized to her, but she also knows that it's probably a little too late. But I hope that our film will do a lot to awaken people to what happened in the 40s in Jim Crow South.
Nancy, I thought that the soundtrack that accompanies The Rape of Recy Taylor was really intelligently chosen, really a magnificent soundtrack. Particularly that last song by Odetta, and then a song by Fannie Lou Hamer. And, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer was a client of the Center for Constitutional Rights. She was one of the organizers of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in 1964. I remember all of that when the Freedom Democratic Party tried to get seated at the Democratic Convention on the grounds that they were excluded because of racism and that the whites that were representing the Democratic Party were illegitimate. And Arthur Canoy from the center represented her. So I felt a direct connection when I heard her singing to you in the movie. Tell us about the soundtrack, though, will you?
Well, first of all, Fannie Lou Hamer has, I think, 4 songs in the film. And we were well aware of her activist history and actually painfully aware of the fact that some of this happened to her family. I think her grandmother had been raped numerous times. And her mother is, I think, a product of one of them. So she's very sensitive to these issues. She was very sensitive to these issues and spoke out about women's bodily integrity many times. So it was an honor to use her music. And I think for those who understood this, a smart thing to do, because we need to honor as many women who were involved with this history as possible. We also tried to find music that was indigenous. There are spirituals on the score. I had the help of, by the way, a very fine music supervisor named Randall Poster. The use of the mashup of This Bitter Earth and In the Nature of Daylight. This Bitter Earth is sung by Dinah Washington, and The Nature of Daylight is a Max Richter score. It's been used before, but we use it a little differently, I think. I think it becomes part of the narrative. And though that's not an indigenous piece of music, it's not as old as some of the other songs on the soundtrack, I think it really does work very well and is strong and evocative piece of music.
And I thought that the archival work was quite good. Happened to know the archivist for the film, who went down to Alabama and saw some of the photographs that she was able to collect. And I thought that Hannah Shepherd did a really good job.
She did an excellent job, and she was kind of a detective too. She wasn't just an archivist, but she managed to uncover things that no one had uncovered before. Some information about the boys that had stayed hidden all these years. Which we have in the film, and there are other things that she uncovered that we weren't able to prove 100%, so it's not in the film because we feel very strongly about being absolutely accurate about the information in the film. But she did a marvelous job, as did many other people on this film. You know, this is, as any film is, a huge collaboration from the cinematography to the other producers who worked on the film to our editor, Anthony Rapoli. Our drone photography is quite amazing, I think. And so I'm very indebted to everybody who worked on this film. I think we all felt a profound responsibility to tell this story and to tell it right.
I hope that our listening audience goes out and sees The Rape of Recy Taylor. And I'm going to ask you in a minute how people can do that. But before I do that, talk about the link between your film and Recy Taylor and the Black Lives Matter movement.
You know, I think there is an overarching relationship to any form of resistance, and especially Black women. And Black women have not had the voice that they should have had throughout Jim Crow South. The fact that they organized as elegantly as they did during that period and became the foundation for the Montgomery bus boycott is quite a reveal in our film, because what we do is we link the bodily assaults, such as the one against Recy Taylor, to women who were molested on buses and in taxi cabs. And we begin to see that the organization around the Montgomery bus boycott is directly linked to Recy Taylor's rape in 1944. So women have been organizing all along. The fact that their voices haven't been heard as strongly as men have is something that we make a point of saying in our film. It's not surprising, and I don't think it's a terrible crime that that's the case, but we are working hard to make sure that that's not the case anymore. I think Black Lives Matter is a wonderful example of Black men and women who are speaking up very forcefully, who are being heard, and are reminding us that there should never be any silencing of people against crimes, who've had crimes perpetrated against them.
Nancy, on a personal note, if you don't mind, how did you develop your political consciousness?
You know, I'm not sure. I think that these things are organic. I think that they come from, you know, one's family and developing empathy as one grows up, and that does come from my family. But I grew up middle class in a suburb of New York, and went to a very mixed high school in New Rochelle, New York. We had only one high school there, so it was ethnically very diverse, and I suspect that that had something to do with it. I began a film in 2008, which came out in 2012, called The Loving Story. And it was the first documentary I made, and I was grabbed by that story in a very profound way. And I can't tell you exactly why, but I felt that as a, you know, middle-class white woman, I had a responsibility to deal with the story where there was injustice against white and blacks. It was a white system that caused the injustice against Richard and Mildred Loving. You know, I feel like we're all responsible. So I guess I do feel an obligation to address these stories. And, you know, I'm happy that they've resonated.
It's just an extraordinary accomplishment, Nancy, to get a film from the beginning of an idea to the New York Film Festival is really impressive. How can our audience get to see The Rape of Recy Taylor?
Well, first, I would encourage everybody to go to our Facebook page, The Rape of Recy Taylor, because we will be announcing other screenings, and we also have a website, which is therapeofrecytaylor.com. But I think the Facebook page will be the best way of communicating what we're doing. We are planning a theatrical release in New York and L.A. and hope to do so in other parts of the country. We also have a huge impact campaign being organized. Our co-producers, Transform Films and Odyssey Impact, are working with us to get this film to communities and to churches and to grassroots organizations who might not normally see this movie. So we'll be doing festivals. We'll be in theaters. We will probably be on television at some point. But we will also be reaching out to many people who might not normally see this film. And we encourage you to stay in touch with us so we can let you know when this movie will be available.
Just so people get this accurately, Recy is spelled R-E-C-Y, Recy Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R.
Nancy, it's really been an honor to meet with you, and congratulations on your accomplishment.
Well, thank you very much. We really honor Recy Taylor and her family. That's what this film is right. about. And if I can congratulate anybody, it's Recy Taylor, who is still alive and still here.
Here's to Recy.
Nancy Bursky, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Oh, Lord, you know just how I feel. 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 Oh, Lord, they say you're on surprise. Oh, Lord, they said you'd answer prayer. Oh, Lord, they say you would answer prayer. Oh, Lord, say you would answer prayer. Oh, Lord, I'm coming to you again. Oh, Lord, I'm coming to you again. Oh, Lord, coming to you again. Oh, Lord, coming to you again. Oh, Lord, we sure do need you now. Oh, Lord, we sure do need you now. Oh, Lord, sure do need you now. Oh, Lord, sure do need you now. Oh, Lord, they've done been here and gone.
Puerto Rico is the only remaining U.S. colony in the Western Hemisphere. 3.5 million people live on the island. They lack representatives in Congress, and the population is barred from voting in the U.S. presidential elections. Although it's $73 billion in debt to American banks, by law, it is unable to declare bankruptcy and restructure its debt. President Donald Trump said that the impact of Maria was partly the fault of Puerto Rico falling into a giant amount of debt that it has not repaid. With an already stressed-out infrastructure, the island in the past 3 weeks was hit by 2 extremely powerful hurricanes. Electricity and cell services are down. People are drinking water out of creeks. They have little fuel, little food, and the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulin Cruz, is sleeping on a cot. The mounting death toll is presently at 34. President Trump accused the San Juan mayor of poor leadership after she criticized the American government for not helping Puerto Rico enough after Hurricane Maria. Trump said she was a politically motivated ingrate. Then he barred her from participating in a group phone call to talk about relief, telling her she could listen in but not speak. He then accused the Puerto Rican people of being lazy, saying that they want everything done for them. Here to speak with us today is the Puerto Rican president of the National Lawyers Guild, Natasha Lycia Orobanin. She has recently returned from Cuba, which also suffered severely from Hurricane Maria, but responded in a much more effective way. Natasha, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start. Have you been in touch with family and relatives on the island?
I've been in touch with some of my loved ones down there, but there's still many that I have not heard from yet. And it's basically the same story all around. Just a lot of devastation. Almost exclusively, everyone is still without water, very minimal food, no electricity.
What kind of aid is the United States providing to this emergency?
It's a really great question. We'd all like to know that.
Paper towels.
Yeah. How absolutely disgraceful.
Yeah, I saw that photograph of Trump throwing people paper towels.
Yeah. I think that that picture is perhaps the most symbolic image of colonialism. Right? Just looking at that picture and having a sense for what he thinks about not only Puerto Ricans, but really people of color, immigrants, people don't speak English as their first language. It's just really symbolic of his policies towards all Latinos. You know, I think the aid question is something we're all trying to figure out. Initially, the first week where there was just an absolute kind of ignoring of the crisis, we know that FEMA personnel, the few that were sent to the island, most didn't speak Spanish. So not very helpful. As of a couple of days ago, I understand that even those who have found their way to San Juan and made it to the center where FEMA representatives are, they often are told their system's been shut down and to go wait in line or to go online. Well, there is no online. People can't get online. There is no internet. There's very poor phone reception, so you can't call. And that's just in San Juan. The rest of the island, you know, there's 78 municipalities. It's extremely clear there is no aid getting there. There's been a centralized effort of all aid that's been sent to the island by the government, federal and local. And it's not being distributed outside of San Juan. Over and over, every single time I go online, I hear of another town that has not seen a single official of any government in over 2 weeks, right? These are all citizen-led initiatives to try to help each other get water. People are now going to the creek to bathe, to get drinking water there, where they can, boiling it over firewood. No food, no electricity, no water.
I read today that the U.S. government refuses to allow people to redeem food stamps for hot meals. And since it's hard to buy food and hard to cook the food, but there are some stores open which sell hot meals like Burger King, they're not allowed to even do that. So they're literally starving.
Yeah, hot meals have become a luxury, right? Hot meal, shower, having a full tank of gas, those are all, you know, having electricity have all become luxuries.
Not to mention water for sewage and public health issues.
Exactly. You know, the public health crisis, I think, is something that hasn't been so heavily reported on. But when you're talking about there's no sanitation, right, that trash is being thrown outside or in people's homes with no pickup. If you don't have water, you know, using the bathroom, just taking care of basic necessities and what that looks like if things are sitting in your house, right? And the airborne pollutants that come from stagnant water. Not only that, and one of the most tragic and invisible consequences, people have died in massive numbers that are going unreported. And they are burying their loved ones in their backyards. They're putting them in bags and, you know, putting them on the roofs, putting them outside. Beyond the lack of dignity for that kind of a situation. Obviously, there are also health issues that arise from that. Weeks of this kind of scenario unaddressed from a health perspective, you can imagine the consequences that are going to come out of this, particularly outside of San Juan.
The United States military has about 800 bases in 81 countries around the world. What kind of presence does the military have in Puerto Rico?
I think if you look in the last couple of days, you would say they have an extreme presence, right? The Navy closed their bases about 15 years ago after the massive civil disobedience movement in Vieques, which was a great success. But there's obviously still a military presence on the island. And I think that when you look at this, one of the things that I find most striking, again, to me as kind of a symbol of colonialism, is to go from the Trump administration's absolute lack of response to an overzealous one that was really about military might in response to a humanitarian crisis. So instead of thinking about how to provide food and water, you send generals down. Right? Those are the ones who are now writing press conferences in English in a Spanish-speaking poor island, right, who doesn't necessarily understand. Many people won't necessarily understand what they're saying. So the response is a military one. And I think that's also probably part due to the fact that other countries had begun to offer aid, recognizing the absolute failure of the colonizing nation to respond to what was happening in their colony. And to show them, no, we're the ones here who are in control. We're going to send military personnel down, military planes, who aren't necessarily bringing aid, right? If that was the purpose, that you were going to deploy the Coast Guard or the Navy because they have the planes and they have the boats to be able to give aid, well, that's not what's happening still, right? It's a show of force, which is what Trump is about, right? He's about an image that says that I'm power with no substance behind it. So people continue to starve despite the fact that we've deployed military personnel down there.
Yeah, the military, I think, is there to keep people in place. It's not there to help. If they wanted to help, I mean, most of the outlying areas outside of San Juan haven't been touched by anybody bringing aid. If the military was there to help, the military during Vietnam had 500,000 troops halfway around the world, and they brought food to them. They brought supplies to them. They brought clothes to them. So the military could do something, but I think what they're doing is just what you said, you know, keeping law and order.
Exactly. And there's still aid that's not being released that nobody understands why. Warehouses of aid. What is the holdup? Is it originally, we understand the local government was trying to centralize all efforts to then redistribute them, and then the federal government decided to show up and take over that and is holding it hostage? Why is the aid not being released? What are they there for, if not to do that? If you're going to deploy military personnel, where's the Army Corps of Engineers to help with the infrastructure and rebuilding roads? Why isn't the Navy bringing, you know, supplies to Vieques and Culebra? Where, if the Coast Guard is there, the Air Force, whoever, why is aid not being distributed over 2 weeks later? We would never have seen that in the continental U.S.
Yeah, I mean, the United States didn't do much for the first week after Maria hit. Trump was out on a golf course. And when they finally got around to doing it, it was very minimal. And Trump flies over there, lands on an Air Force base, meets with everybody on an aircraft carrier, and gets home by the early evening.
And meets with people from one of the richest districts, you know, where most of the population in that town, part of San Juan, are bilingual and are English-speaking, and is literally one of the wealthiest zip codes, you know, on the island, right? Absolutely disconnected from the reality of the rest of the
island.
And
then when he gets there, he minimizes the situation. Says, oh, Katrina was much worse.
And more than minimizes, he disregards it. Basically saying, your lives aren't valuable, right? The lives of, quote-unquote, real Americans are the ones that that count here.
Natasha, do you think that is in part because Puerto Rico is still really a colony decades after the Civil Rights Movement and decades after the decolonization era because of the desire and power of the U.S. military?
That's exactly right. Puerto Rico is one of the oldest colonies in the region, right? It's been a colony for over 500 years, 119 of which have been under the United States' rule. And this scenario, first the economic crisis that led in so many ways to the inability of Puerto Rico to prepare itself for a disaster of this magnitude, its failing infrastructure, its inability to fund public services, to prepare its citizens for that, exacerbated tremendously by this unnatural disaster. And now its inability to respond. And all of that is about its colonial status. It has no capacity to build its economy, to receive aid from foreign governments. The United States has to approve whether Cuba can send brigades of electricians and physicians there to help people who are literally dying, right? It is disgraceful, and it is the burden of all of us who live in the U.S. to hold our government accountable for ongoing violations of international law and to call this out for what it is. If anything is more obvious now, in the last year, after the passage of PROMESA, which was the federal legislation that imposed a colonial control board over Puerto Rico, and now this administration's response to the hurricane, it is that Puerto Rico continues to be a colony.
Yeah, seven people on this PROMESA board call all the financial shots. The Supreme Court has recently affirmed Puerto Rico is not sovereign, and it's recently affirmed that they cannot, like any other state or municipality, declare bankruptcy and restructure its debt. So they're really at the mercy of seven people who want to get the $73 billion that Puerto Rico owes. They want to get it back. Not that the Puerto Rican people had anything to do with agreeing to that debt. They didn't. But now they have to pay it back. So they're taking it out of their hides. Education, medical facilities, roads. They even, vulture capitalists, want to buy the electric company, which is owned by Puerto Rico. So far, they've resisted that buyout. But I think this is what Naomi Klein would call vulture capitalism.
Absolutely.
They use this crisis to privatize things.
Natasha, I understand that the United States Supreme Court has ruled that, quote, as alien races, Puerto Ricans were not entitled to full constitutional rights. Is that really true?
Yeah, that's the doctrine from the insular cases. That was really a series of cases trying to figure out what to do with these territorial acquisitions after the Spanish-American War in 1898, which I call colonies. To what extent should we recognize the rights of these individuals who belong to a lesser race than us? Does the Constitution follow the flag, essentially? And that doctrine is still in place. None of those cases have ever been overturned. The full Bill of Rights has not been extended, for example, to Puerto Rico, and it's based on colony by colony, right? Whether it's an incorporated, unincorporated. The Supreme Court case that you mentioned, Michael Sanchez Valle from last year, doesn't address that at all. If anything, without ever using the word colony, it explicitly defines colonialism. And it says you have no sovereignty, right? Look at this series of cases, right? You don't have the same rights. Your autonomy comes from us. Whatever sense of sovereignty you have, it's because we grant it to you, and at any time we can take it away. We can overrule your government. We could impose a new government over you the same way that we did for the first 60 years of your existence, right? This government, all three branches, for the first time last year, spoke very clearly by saying, you're our colony, right? We have full ability to determine your lives and your future. And that should be outrageous to all of us, right? This narrative that I think gets used a lot, well, Puerto Ricans are American citizens, so we should care. I think misses the whole picture. One, that citizenship was imposed on another country. It was never asked for, and it was only imposed so that the United States had a justification to send them to war in World War I, right? We need more meat for our cannon. This a saying in Spanish that says that, right? We need more meat, essentially. And these are people who are disposable. Let's send them there, right? It was never asked for. And it's not full citizenship, as you just pointed out, Heidi, right? It's partial citizenship. But beyond that, their value doesn't come from their citizenship, right? It's 3.5 million people's lives who have been struggling as part of another nation who should be respected because they should be respected, because they have inherent dignity.
I just wanted to ask you about the Jones Act, which is one of the manifestations of the lack of sovereignty, because the Jones Act says that all the food and supplies coming into Puerto Rico have to be carried by American ships. And as a consequence, and I was shocked the first time I went there years ago, how expensive everything was. I didn't understand how the Jones Act worked then. But finally, Trump was pressured, although he didn't want to do it, and he said a lot of his friends were shippers. He was finally pressured into suspending the Jones Act so other countries could send stuff on non-American ships. But he only suspended it for 10 days. What's that all about?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, the initial request from Congresswoman Nidia Velázquez was fell on deaf ears. Trump explicitly said he was not going to overturn he was not going to grant the waiver for the Jones Act. And then because of tremendous public pressure, he decided to grant it, but like you said, for 10 days. Well, 10 days of allowing non-U.S. flagships to come in to respond to a crisis that he waited, you know, a couple of weeks to respond to, and of this magnitude, is not going to do much in terms of disaster relief. You need minimum a year waiver, but what you really need is the Jones Act overturned, right? It is detrimental to the Puerto Rican economy because ships, say, coming in from Spain, dock in Boston. In Boston, they can receive their goods immediately. But that ship, then, if it's going to continue to carry goods to Puerto Rico, has to change to a U.S. flagship and then go down. And all of those costs get transferred and passed on to the people in Puerto Rico to the tune of about $500 million a year for an impoverished island nation that should not be bearing those costs. This is a 100-year-old bill whose time has come and gone, right? This is not the way that business happens, how most people receive their goods anymore, unless you're an island nation. And because Puerto Rico's economy has been obliterated because of 119 years of colonialism and U.S. capitalist interest there, now 85% of their food gets imported. And so imagine when it's to your point, how expensive things are, when you have to import that amount of food and products, you're heavily dependent on ships. It's an absolute business. And some people are definitely making money off it, but I can tell you it's impoverishing the people of Puerto Rico.
What do you make of Trump's statement in an interview when he was on the island last week that he might forgive the debt?
He said that, yeah, when he was there a couple of days ago. He said that, and then within a few hours, the White House clarified that that will never happen.
Well, he has no power to do it.
Right, of course not.
Right.
You know, I think it's pretty symbolic of Trump, period, just saying things that are either outright lies or not grounded in reality or basis or not, you know, even representative of what he actually thinks. He says whatever he wants to say in the moment, and we can't ever take him seriously. And that was evident by the fact that the White House clarified that will never happen, that what he meant to say, this is right, his now spokesman trying to interpret Trump for Trump and for the American people, is that what he meant to say was that the people of Puerto Rico have a lot of debt to pay and that they need to figure out how they're going to do it,
yeah.
Right?
I think one of the ironic aspects of all of this is that U.S. capital went down to Puerto Rico because they got tax breaks. And the U.S. pharmaceuticals built huge manufacturing plants down there that employ 100,000 Puerto Ricans that make some of the most significant drugs that people in the United States take. And now those plants don't have diesel fuel to run. The workers can't get to work. They're pleading for them to come in. They can't even make it to work. And all these medicines for heart disease and cancer and so on are not going to get here. That's an interesting wrinkle. I think that may be an explanation on why there's some pressure on the United States to do more for Puerto Rico.
Yeah, it's not only people standing in line, literally, and these are, you know, very close friends of mine who have slept overnight waiting to get gas, you know, in line at the gas station, who have spent easy 10 hours, 11 hours, 16 hours in line waiting to get gas. That's just be able to get to somebody's house to check in on your loved one. Imagine if you're a business, right? How are you not only going to continue to run, but encourage your employees to come? And that's the pressure point that I think you're right about, that because we know that this administration is oblivious and disrespectful of all Puerto Rican needs, they are attuned to business interests. So to the extent that there are businesses who are saying, this is what we need, listen to us, right, that Trump will listen. Because it's not just enough that people can't get gas or food or water or medicine. It's what the business community needs.
Natasha, we just have a few minutes remaining. I understand that you recently returned from Cuba. Can you contrast the differences in the two islands?
I had the opportunity of being in Cuba both right before Hurricane Irma passed and then a couple of weeks after. And the contrast with Puerto Rico is night and day. To see how the Cubans responded to cleaning up their island right after a devastating hurricane, not necessarily to the extent of Puerto Rico, but parts of the island truly were devastated. There were 10 Cubans who lost their lives as a result of Irma. And the streets of Havana were flooded. You know, you had huge 80-year-old, 100-year-old trees that were down, and you can't tell. 3 weeks later, you can't tell, right? The level of response by the government and by the citizenry is just unprecedented. And you contrast that with Puerto Rico 2 weeks later and the devastation that exists. But even basic things like the flooding, like the downed trees, like the damage to roads and that were impassable, you know, that's not what I saw in Cuba. Even just a little bit outside of Havana, you were able to see very few remnants of the devastation that Irma left, right? Because of their government understanding that their fundamental responsibility is to ensure the well-being and safety of their citizens.
How can people get involved and help?
There are so many ways. I can tell you the first thing to do for those who are interested and able to donate funds, they will always be received. The Maria Fund, which is just mariafund.org, is a real community-led initiative in Puerto Rico that's collecting funds for some of the communities that have been most affected, but really the most vulnerable also, and often neglected communities, some of the poorest communities, Afro-Puerto Rican communities down there. I strongly recommend donating to them. But also, if you're... there's collection efforts across the country in every large city. Everything is needed, right? Food, water, clothes, batteries, flashlights, particularly anything that's solar powered. Solar powered flashlights, solar powered electric plants, they're all needed. If you have contacts with boats, with ships, with pilots, it's all needed right now.
Before we have to say goodbye, Natasha, your final thoughts?
These have been a hard few weeks, I think, for the Caribbean as a whole, as we see the devastation that these unnatural storms and climate policy has done. It has devastated an entire region. And that's our responsibility, right? I mean, I think of Puerto Rico for obvious reasons, and because the Puerto Rico that existed 2 weeks ago will never exist again. If you had a chance to go down before, then you were lucky. You saw what the island was. That's not going to be the island that we'll ever see again in this lifetime. There will be another Puerto Rico. There will be hopefully another Barbuda and Antigua and all of the Caribbean islands that were devastated by this hurricane season as a result of our policies. You know, and this is a call to conscience. This is a collective burden that we all share. This isn't just about Puerto Rico. This is about what we say and do related to the government that makes actions and decisions or lack of them in our name, whether it's about colonialism, whether it's about destructive climate policies that target the global South, our communities, our families, our countries, and how we say, you know, conmigo no cuenta, right? Not, you can't count on me anymore, not in my name.
Natasha Bannon, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you both.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.